Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Roger F. Pasquier, who has spent a career in ornithology and conservation at Environmental Defense Fund, the American Museum of Natural History, and the National Audubon Society and the Smithsonian Institution. But tonight, we're talking about a sort of different book for him. We're talking about his book, Painting Central Park. Roger, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Now, I was familiar with you as a person who has a long career in ornithology and conservation and books based on that. Whenever I found out that you did this book and I actually read it and looked at it, this is an impressive and beautiful art book. How did you come to write it?
Well, thanks very much. I've been interested in birds and art since I was a boy, and when I think about it, I think what appeals and attracted me to both of them is it's a form of visual analysis to identify birds, understand what's going on in a painting. So having grown up in New York City, I spent my youth as well as my life ever since in Central Park and also in museums, and when I was in college and graduate school, I was an art history major. It was only later that I started seeing paintings of Central Park, or they started registering, and it was when I was in Washington working at the Smithsonian that I went across the mall to the Hirshhorn Museum and saw a painting that really put me on this course, which is the George Bellows painting of the Bethesda Fountain done on a very gray November day.
Oh, yeah.
First, that painting made me so homesick for New York, but second, it made me think how many other paintings of Central Park there must be, and that it might be an interesting book. And from that time on, 1978, until I started working on this in 2012, I worried, would somebody else come up with this idea and do this book long before me? Happily, nobody did, and when I retired, this was the first project I wanted to do.
I am so glad you did it. It is a wonderful book to read. Let's talk about it. First of all, Central Park, as you write in the book, has been called one of the greatest works of art in America. When I opened the book and saw that big two-page spread of one of the first paintings of the site before construction began, I had no idea what I was looking at. It didn't look like anything I knew. And let's talk about the creation of Central Park. I mean, when was Central Park created?
The work began in 1858 and was pretty much finished by 1863 or 1865, and some buildings were added in the few years thereafter. But before that, there had been long recognition that the city needed a piece of open green space. The question was where to put it, and the first proposal in the 1840s or early 1850s was in an area that today is part of the East Side on, I think, from about 3rd Avenue to the East River, from somewhere in the 60s to about 75th Street. But they realized that this was not going to be big enough, and at just the same time in the late 50s, the New York City Water Authority was planning to build a new reservoir in some place that had not yet been settled and was available, and the Water Authority, whatever that was properly called, said to the commissioners of the planned park, let's do this together. There's a lot of space up here. Let's put it all together. And so that's what led to the identification of the area initially from 59th Street to 106th Street, from 5th Avenue to 8th Avenue as the boundaries of what would be the park. A few years later, from 106th to 110th were added because that was rocky and swampy ground that they recognized nobody would build anything on anyway, so they might as well add it to the park.
And it was Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux who had the winning competition for the Greensward plan. And you have those drawings reproduced in your book, and I found those fascinating too. When you look at that first painting of Central Park before it was even created, what goes through your mind as a person who walks the park a lot? There's no framing buildings. It's just a big sort of morass of different kinds of habitats.
Well, of course, the original habitat, the forest, and whatever water bodies were there were long gone, and most of this land was cut and pretty degraded. There was we have to remember an African-American village called Seneca Village in the area that's near the west side on near Central Park West from about 82nd to 89th Street. But other than that, I don't think there were any major settlements, although there were some property owners who had to be bought out. And I'm looking at this picture right now. It depicts an area that has since become the lake in the center of Central Park, but it shows, the picture shows by what it lacks how much creativity and how much work went into creating the topography and making visible the key landmarks that we enjoy today.
How difficult was it to track down these paintings? Because these are paintings that span a huge time period from a variety of artists, many of which are well-known artists, but some not so well-known. How difficult was it tracking down these works?
Well, it was a big treasure hunt. And of course, at the start, I didn't know how much I would find, but fairly quickly, I saw that there were about 80 major American painters and a few Europeans as well who had worked in Central Park. And some of these paintings are in museums and are in the standard books about some of the major artists. But I wanted to show paintings that hadn't been published or exhibited. And I realized that the best way to do that was to go through the auction catalogs of American painting sales of Sotheby's and Christie's.
Wow.
Where things pass through from one private collection often into another and are visible for just a few days in their galleries before they're auctioned off. So I went to the Metropolitan Museum and said what I needed, and rather than bringing the long series of catalogs up to me, they sent me down into the basement stacks where these were, and I went backwards from 2014 when I started on this back to 1990, and that was a wonderful source of paintings by people whom I knew painted the park but whose works had not all been well known, as well as discovering paintings by artists who you would never think painted Central Park and or anything in New York City, who did occasionally, and happily there they were, and we were able to include many of those paintings as well.
I was shocked to see Marc Chagall included.
Yes, well, that's an amusing story, because after the book was pretty much done, I was at Christie's one day to look at a collection of what are called modern and contemporary paintings. There was this painting, put it this way, there was this painting that I recognized as Central Park, and as I approached it, what a surprise to see that it was by Marc Chagall. So that was a great surprise to find that just pretty much at the last minute in one of the auction houses. And then the very next week, Sotheby's had its comparable sale, and there was a painting by David Hockney of Central Park. So it was great to be able to include these two Europeans in the book.
Now, in the late 1800s, American artists would travel to Europe and do paintings of the well-to-do people in their parks in Europe. But once Central Park was created and was up and running with the horseback riding, the ice skating, and the carriage riding and stuff like that, it has a very European feel to it. These early paintings of the first 30 years of Central Park, to my eye, have a very European sensibility to them.
Well, that's absolutely right, and it took me a while to realize the connection, because painters from America in those days routinely went to Europe for a training, and by the time they came back, the contemporary European works that were popular were also pretty well known, at least in the American cities, and these painters thought, well, now where can we paint anything remotely like what the market is asking for and what people are spending large sums to buy from Europe? Well, Central Park was the only American park that had the infrastructure comparable to what exists in Paris and London. And so this is one of several reasons that so many of these artists gravitated to New York in the last decades of the 19th century and painted in a very impressionist style that was highly marketable, of the same themes of generally affluent or genteel people in their leisure activities. And Central Park was exactly the place where this was happening.
I was also fascinated to learn that there were a number of Currier and Ives prints of Central Park. And it's interesting, these were distributed around the United States. And so the country as a whole had an idea of what Central Park looked like.
That's right. And Central Park was if not the very first, certainly the largest park in any city, followed by Prospect Park in Brooklyn, which at that time was a separate city, but certainly larger than, vastly larger than the Boston Common, and larger than anything in Philadelphia. So I think people in America were probably interested to see that cities could create a landscape as enormous as a park in the center, or what would be eventually be the center of their city, and that it would offer so many forms of recreational activity. So, yes, the prints of Currier and Ives and others were a great way to disseminate what was happening in New York City and what was available to people in New York City.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Roger F. Pasquier. And he spent a career in ornithology and conservation in organizations like the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Audubon Society, the American Museum of Natural History, and the Smithsonian Institution. But tonight we're talking about an absolutely stunning book that he's put together called Painting Central Park. One of the things you do in this book that I just thought was smashing in the old British sense, you do a walk in the park with the painters. And describe what you did in this.
Well, when I found all of the paintings that I wanted to include, I thought, how do I organize this book? Because you could do it chronologically by artist, or you could do it by locale. There were several ways to do it. And there are some other themes that I hope we'll talk about that we cover in this book. But certainly the best thing after the introductory chapter that shows how the park was created and the earliest depictions was to take every reader through the park from the southern end of 59th Street up to 110th Street, so that people who already know the park would see it through the artist, see the familiar landmarks and landscapes through the artist's eye, and people who do not know the park would get a sense of its expanse and the diversity of its landscapes. So we do start at Grand Army Plaza and find paintings that cover the landscapes and the landmarks all the way up to 110th Street. And then in other chapters, other themes are treated that are not organized by so much by locale, but by activity.
So, in keeping with the walk through the park, were there any locations where you could not, that you wanted to include, but you couldn't find a painting represented?
Yes, surprisingly, if you know the conservatory garden up at 105th Street, which has an English garden, an Italian garden, and a French garden, we didn't find any painters that had depicted it. The gardens were created in the 1930s at the order of Robert Moses, but that left almost 80 years for some artists to be inspired by that. Unfortunately, we just didn't find any painters that had done that area, so we asked a New York painter named Simon Parks to go up there and do whatever, whose landscapes in the city and the New York area countryside are well known and admired, just go up and do whatever you like. So he came back with a painting of the pergola of the Italian garden, and that helped us fill in a gap for that part of the park. I don't think there was any other part of the park that artists had not gone to, even at the far northern ends, which were far less depicted than the southern half of the park.
I just want to mention a couple of my favorite paintings from this section, and maybe if you can say a word or two about the artists. Rackstraw Downs, The Oval Lawn,
yes.
1977. I was not that familiar with that artist.
Oh, well, he is English, and he came to America in the 1960s. As I recall, he studied at Yale. He came to New York in 1965 and did some landscapes of Central Park very soon after he arrived in the sort of heavy impasto style. I show one or two later in the book. But this large horizontal landscape
wow.
of the Great Lawn really at its nadir in, I think, 1977, before the Central Park Conservancy had been created, when the city had no money to restore the lawns. They were heavily eroded. It's a wonderful painting with a kind of English sky and a vast panorama, and people, I'm looking at it right now, people doing all kinds of activities on the Great Lawn. And it was a kind of precursor to the work that he's done in Portland, in Texas, and Portland, Maine, in Texas, and wow, other places, focused on sort of industrial sites, highway overpasses, and other kinds of places that most people would look at thinking there's an intrinsic beauty in here.
Yeah.
But he has found it, and I've always admired the shows that come up every 3 or 4 years at one of the 57th Street galleries that show him, and I was so happy to make contact with him and receive not only permission to use this painting, but have him show me some of the other smaller paintings that I've mentioned, one of which I used in this and a couple others in a different book.
First of all, I've always loved Richard Estes' work.
Yeah.
And you've got several of them in the book. The equestrian statue viewed mm-hmm. from the bus, which I love that. Central Park looking north. I love his work. They're sort of preternaturally still. There's a weird stillness to his works that is very odd. Those are just beautifully reproduced. But you have Edward Hopper. You have, I think, two paintings by him. Shakespeare at Dusk. First of all, that's one of the things that seemed to really inspire a lot of artists, the lighting effects through the year, especially in the winter, mm-hmm. winter skies. You have this Edward Hopper Shakespeare at Dusk, but then you have an Edward Hopper that I would never have expected and I'd never seen before in this book, and that's of the equestrians.
Yes.
What a weird, that's completely out of his, anything would recognize as his.
Well, yes, so one would think at first, because you're quite right, it's one of the only paintings that I know where he has figures in motion rather than standing around looking out the window, or the famous one of the usher in the movie theater. But there's a kind of interior isolation about each of these three figures as well. And very curiously, this painting was in the collection of the San Francisco Museum of Art, whatever that's properly called, and it came up, they decided that this was a painting that they could deaccession and to use those funds for acquisition of other works. I don't know how many Hoppers there are in San Francisco or any place in Northern California, but this is such an extraordinary painting.
It's amazing.
I was surprised that they chose to sell it, and so that passed through, I think it was at Sotheby's, and is now, so far as I know, in a private collection. So I was very glad to include it, and you know, every day when I happen to pass the Dakota, which is in the background of this painting, I think of it.
There's a painting I am so glad that you included, because I've actually used it in my birding lectures, and you know what's coming. It's a very odd painting.
Yes,
George Clare Tooker, Birdwatchers.
Right.
And that, right, there's something really deeply strange about that painting.
Well, George Tooker is the only person who has ever painted birdwatchers in the park, which from my point of view, of course, is an essential activity there. But he was not a birdwatcher himself, but he went on at least one bird walk with some other people and decided that this was an interesting subject to depict after he had done several paintings of people looking very apprehensively around them in the subway or otherwise not feeling entirely comfortable. It's not clear that these people in the ramble are entirely comfortable either, and there's a lot of ambiguity about what way they're looking, what they're looking at, but it's an important picture just to show what does go on in the ramble.
Now, you have sections on the leisure activities, and these are wonderful. So there's an entire section of ice skating paintings, for instance. I love the ice skating paintings. There's something about the setting and then the use of light, especially at night or as it's getting dark, that really inspired painters to do things with the effects of light.
Well, that's true, because in the early days, the Central Park was the only place that was available for ice skating. When you consider that New York is a city of Dutch origin, it's amazing that there was no place that people could skate until the park was created with the artificial lakes. Whenever the largest, the one we call the lake, froze, people rushed out there, and on nights when the ice was solid, they kept the park open till midnight, 4 hours later than usual, so people could skate there. So there are several night scenes of people skating in the park. And to me, one of the interesting things about the Dutch link is that ice skating pictures are so typically Dutch. Here in the New York ones, you see all the little genre touches that the Dutch ones had as well. Somebody falling over, people speeding. In one painting that I'm looking at right now, there's, and remember, these are all done in the 19th century when women wore long skirts. There are people who like to walk on the ice as well as others who skate. And in the corner of this one painting, there is a woman who is looking back at a man who's put his foot on her skirt so she can't get away from him. So this is sort of a gateway to all the ways that women benefited from ice skating, which was a sport that they were allowed to do, didn't have a chaperone with them, and it was correct to be skating on the arms of another person, either a friend or a man friend, who could have been your husband, your fiancé, your beau, or perhaps somebody that you had just met. So this was a kind of new field of activity and social encounters for women. But the women were conscious of all of this and asked for and received a portion of the lake that men were not allowed to go onto unless they were escorting a woman, so that women could skate without the kinds of disturbance that I described in the corner of this this first painting.
Another fascinating section in your book, and this for me is wonderfully done by you. When all the buildings finally went up around the park, you have this frame around the park, and that starts changing the subject matter and how it's perceived by the artists. People look through the trees of Central Park to the buildings. People look from the buildings down into Central Park. It's a really fascinating thing that happens as those buildings are built up to frame the park.
Right. So when the park was created, there were essentially no buildings around what was then the periphery. And certainly whatever buildings there were, remember this was before there was elevators, there were elevators with steel construction, were nothing larger than individual houses. But the park, of course, transformed the value of the land all around the periphery, and the march of the city uptown as it became more populous brought people to the latitudes of the park, and also the same era led to the new inventions of elevators and steel framing, so that you could build tall buildings. And so this park was very soon surrounded by buildings, first houses and then apartment buildings, which became popular early or were first invented in the late 19th century, became popular and increasingly popular after the First War, so that indeed there is a kind of palisade of buildings, all extremely interesting architecturally, and some of New York's most iconic buildings around the park that became very interesting for painters to depict, as well as for painters to go into and do practically aerial views or angular views down into the park. So that opened up a whole new way to depict the park.
On the cover of this book is a painting, I think it's by Adolph Den, Spring in Central Park, 1941. That is a very Parisian-looking painting. It reminds me of Raoul Dufay or something. It has that sort of really sort of fantastic look to it that's just absolutely wonderful.
Well, you're right to point out that this was on the cover of the book, because when you think about what do you put on the cover of a book so that the subject is instantly recognizable, most of the paintings in the book are showing parts of the park that could perhaps be elsewhere or are recognizable only to people who already know the park. But when you have a building that has Rockefeller Center and the big hotels on Central Park South, in the background, everybody in the world knows that, and the Empire State behind those, everybody in the world knows this is Central Park. So Adolf Dane did several views from this very specific spot, which you can pass as you're going west past the Bethesda Terrace towards the Dakota. Wow. And this springtime view that we put on the cover is rather like Raoul Dufy, because it has the same sort of bright colors that he did, and the same small figures doing genre scenes.
We're almost out of time. And we could be talking about this book for years. It's so good. I just want to mention the most abstract view in this book is by Helen Frankenthaler. No surprise.
Well, it was a surprise to find. First, believe it or not, she is the only woman artist whom I could find who has depicted the park. And it was thrilling to find this painting, because I would never have guessed Helen Frankenthaler did Central Park, although I know very well, because she's the aunt of a friend of mine and stepmother of a classmate of my sister, that she lived right on 94th Street. And in the 60s, she did a number of paintings that she gave the titles of specific locales, Cape Cod and Central Park, to this one. So it was very exciting to discover this and be able to include it.
We're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight, Roger F. Pasquier, who has spent a career in ornithology and conservation at organizations and institutions like the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Audubon Society, the American Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian. But we've been talking about a really enjoyable, wonderful book that he's put together, Painting Central Park. Roger, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks. It's been great fun for me to talk with you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.